Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are excited to have everybody on the show tonight. We've got a full house and it's going to be a great episode, but we can't even begin to think about everyone else on the show because we haven't even introduced the most important person on the show, Sam Bradley.
Ah, gee, Jimmy, I think I'm blushing. Yes, we are doctor-centric tonight. We have some of our favorite docs, which you've heard from before, and a lot of really interesting topics based on some articles that they recently put out there. And our, well, if I say favorite meteorologist, somebody may have his feelings hurt. But one of our favorite people, Becky DePodwin, and I want to hit you up a little bit. I hear it's raining cats and dogs there on the East Coast. What's up with that?
Yeah, well, we're wound down here in central Pennsylvania. We topped off about 1.5 to 2 inches of rain across the area, causing some localized flooding. Jamie should be winding down soon, but I imagine he had pretty similar totals farther south. Really a potent system just pulling in a ton of moisture from the Gulf. Just widespread amounts of 1 or 2 inches all across the eastern seaboard.
So what's it look like for next week? Anything terrible on the horizon?
No, nothing too bad, actually. The pattern kind of settles down a little bit, which is good because there's been a lot of severe weather in the south and southeast. So we do quiet down a little bit. There's not a whole lot in the way of major severe weather outbreaks, although it is the spring, so thunderstorms are a given. But still kind of on the cooler side. We can't seem to shake this pattern and actually get to a pattern where we have average or above average temperatures in the east. But I hear you were pretty warm earlier in the week, Sam.
Yeah, it was in the 70s. It was comfortable. But I keep getting forewarned by my people here in Colorado that it could still snow next week. That's kind of how May works out here.
Yeah, you know, Colorado.
you know.
Any month.
Exactly. Well, we're going to jump into this. We got, again, some of our favorite doctors, Dr. Seth Hawkins, Dr. Ben Abo, the snake guy, and Dr. Sarah Frances McClure. And we're going to jump into this because we have a lot to talk about. So let me find the top of my notes here. You have coined some terms, Seth. But first, I want to talk, this is how this all started anyway. What about COVID in the wilderness? People are probably thinking, yeah, I need a break. I'm going to go out and take a hike. Can COVID live on wood and other surfaces? Are there some dangers of contracting this out there?
Yeah, I think many of us are looking at the wilderness and the outdoors as our relief from social distancing and from being inside for Lord knows how many days now. It's been a bit of a push and pull situation across the country as we've seen record numbers of people coming to our state parks and our federal wilderness areas and national forests. Interestingly, each of those areas in particular, places like state parks that are pretty heavily curated have a carrying capacity that can be exceeded. So one of the challenges is that we probably can't fit all these people who are looking for their recreational activities into the areas that we've set aside for that purpose in the size and the coverage that they have right now. So that's been an interesting facet of it is being victims of our own success of making really cool places to go to and then excluding people from going anywhere else. And in consequence, some wilderness areas and parks and forests have been closing, which is a kind of a unfamiliar and somewhat cognitively dissonant idea for people that the woods and the forests and the mountains and the rivers can be closed. And usually when that's happened, it's because the human impact on those areas has become so great that it's not sustainable. And also because, in fact, they can become like amusement parks with people shoulder to shoulder jostling along a single trail to a waterfall. And social distancing is not possible. So I think one One interesting consideration is the idea that it has, in fact, extended out in some states to the areas that many of us go to for escape and relief. In other places, wilderness areas are open and continue to be used and are a great way for people to get out and get the exercise and natural interaction we all think is really both psychologically and physically important for well-being. During this time. And in those situations, I think some of the things we've been covering in the COVID-19 column in Wilderness Medicine Magazine have been things like you're referring to. How long does the virus live on natural surfaces? What are the cleaning considerations for gear? And I think much of it, a lot of it is interesting from a wonk standpoint, just to know things like half-lives of virus and sunny and dark places and things like that. But I think really the most important thing for listeners boils down to the same considerations as in more traveled areas, meaning that your most likely chance of acquiring an infection will be in the parking lot with close distancing with other people on commonly used appliances. So bathrooms are probably the most high-risk area as far as handles and faucets and things like that. So really, actually, what it boils down to is our considerations for using outdoor resources really are very similar to other areas where we go that have large collections of people.
David Pfeiffer, who is also an expert on in the wilderness and co-authored the article with Seth. And David, we're just talking about, you know, can it be infectious on natural surfaces? How does it work? You know, and Seth was mentioning you can have issues with people all following the same trail and not really having social distancing. But what about if you were to respond to an incident with a number of people in the wilderness? One of my first thoughts is respiratory protection or PPE going to change at all in that environment than it is in the ER or in the field?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I mean, I think it does because of just the limitations in wearing the proper PPE in the environment. So, you know, it's hard enough to wear respiratory protection PPE. So we're talking about basically an N95, right? It's hard enough to wear that in a clinical environment where there's air conditioning and, you know, you don't have to do too many athletic moves and stuff like that. But imagine wearing a tight-fitting respirator mask while you're trying to move a basket along a trail or do an edge transition of that basket or, you know, any number of things where you're going to be sweating and moving around a lot and kind of a lot of facial movements. And, you know, you're wearing sometimes helmets and radio headsets and all that kind of stuff. It's probably not going to work too well. And there's actually some reports and like Ben and Seth might be able to comment on this, anecdotal reports of people who are wearing their respirators for a really long period of time in the clinical environment, starting to get fatigued, get headaches, and some things like that, probably from increased rebreathing of CO2 while they're wearing these respirators. So I think that in the wilderness, you know, maybe N95s for the people closest to the patient, but if you can try to avoid being within close contact with the patient and you're in an open air environment, I probably wouldn't prioritize wearing an N95 as much as I would in a different kind of environment.
Well, that makes perfect sense. And I didn't really think about the issue of rebreathing O2, but that makes perfect sense too. Dr. Ben, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so it's interesting because from the start, I started using, from my urban search and rescue gear, I grabbed extra, just renewed my filters, and just very easy, and I've had been able to switch around between my N95 that the hospital had or ones that I had from USAR and my half-face respirator and all. But so I've been using that early on, and a lot of people have done that as well, you know, found some or I'd help them locate them out. And it's interesting because I warn people in terms of knowing how the ins and outs, how to use them. And most people ask me anyway, in terms of like the time and this and that. And then the ones that, you know, didn't really listen are like, man, how do you wear this for so long? Because I'm like, well, I told you, because from the fire department and from USAR EMS, I'm used to knowing how to use the respirator and work cycles and everything and figuring out how to take a break and take it on and off as needed to give myself a break. And how to recognize the signs of rebreathing and things like that. So I'm definitely seeing it. And I wonder if some of my colleagues that are wearing these respirators, the N95 for too long without a break, if it's affecting their clinical decision-making as well, which is just a whole other level of scariness, with respect to, are they going to continue to be able to protect themselves, making a bad decision in terms of following the rules and what they need to do, and then also just clinical decisions as well.
Wow, that's a really good point. Let's toss that one to Sarah Francis, who happens to work in an ER, a very busy one, I'm sure. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so PPE became very important for us pretty early on. So just to give like a little bit of a timeline of what we were seeing, so we often are listed as the number two or number three busiest emergency department in the United States. So at baseline, we're seeing like 500 patients a day. Pretty high acuity. It's a level one trauma center. So that's what we're used to seeing normally. So I went the weekend of like March 8th. I was with David Pfeiffer at a wilderness medicine conference in Roanoke, Virginia. And, you know, we were still kind of tossing around like, oh, we've seen a few possible cases. We don't really know what's going to happen. Is this going to be like the flu? Is it not? I showed back up to work on March 9th, and things had completely changed in the emergency department. That was the first day of our first positive case. And suddenly we realized that there was going to be no way to contain the infection in rooms. There were so many patients coming in. We have four isolation rooms in the emergency department, and we have very few even closed door rooms. And usually those are used where like standing room only kind of department where they patients sit in chairs kind of around the nursing station. And we'll bring them into the exam room, examine them, and put them back into the chair. Sometimes they have to stand with their IV pole while they're waiting, they're getting their medications. And so there was just going to be not enough rooms for patients to be isolated. So we did go to full PPE 100% of the time while in the emergency department pretty early on.
Well, that's a good thing. And of course, those of us in other parts of the country hear so much about New York and all of the terrible things that are going on there and the number of patients. So we hope you're all being safe there. And I have some other questions I'm going to throw in about that. Well, actually, one is some of the things I picked up from the articles were access to primary care physicians has become almost impossible. So now what do they do? But yet people are afraid to go into the ER for fear. Seth, you told a story about a guy in the article about a guy who was preferred to lose his foot rather than go to the ER when he could have saved it because he was concerned about COVID.
Yeah, we're terming this COVID lateral damage as a play on the concept of collateral damage that happens on the side of anticipated targets and anticipated objectives, and then the damage that occurs unexpectedly. So one of the elements we're seeing is just like that story and millions other millions of others like it, people who are either afraid of seeking care in places like emergency departments or hospitals that they feel like must be consolidated areas of viral load, or people who delay presenting for care because they want to be good citizens and they want to keep emergency departments open for business for covering viral infections. And so they put off things like chest pain that turn out to be heart attacks or weakness that turns out to be strokes. So the message that we're trying to get out universally is that emergencies still occur during this time, that we're well equipped to take care of them, and that emergency departments are still the best place to have your emergency cared for. It is helpful to have some of the lower level primary care services that we sometimes provide be deferred, but any time you would have sought emergency care for a true emergency, you should continue to do so. Now we're afraid to start seeing some of the numbers of conditions that may be worsening as people are not seeking the care that they would have under normal times. And another element to that, just like you point out, it doesn't involve emergency medicine, but involves just routine care. And so there's also a danger that there'll be downstream and increase in complications from people just not getting their routine medications or not getting their routine care, even if it's not an emergency. So I think protecting access to primary care, whether it's through telemedicine or keeping primary care offices open, will be really important.
Well, that was my next thought before I throw this out to everyone else. I'm not going to throw out the topic, but is telemedicine working? And that's a of course, assuming that people have access to it, which is another set of problems. But I don't know how involved you are with it, but does it seem to be working? And Ben, I think, has some thoughts on that. Ben, you want to run with this?
Yeah, so with regards to telemedicine, it's been a huge flux. And I think that there are definitely a lot of pros and a lot of cons out of it. And there are some concerns that I have for ongoing. There's a lot of people that just don't know how, you know, and I practice in an area, I'm in Southwest Florida, Naples, and, you know, you talk about the stereotypical patient that lives down here who a majority of my patients don't know what an iPhone is, and they think the only Apple thing that they really know for a lot of these people is the fruit to eat. So they have issues still with access to even telemedicine. So we're having to educate and go around and try and figure out how people can take care of it with others, check on their family members, lend them the phone, whatever they can do to get access to it. There's also physicians who flat out just kind of are for now, our office is kind of closed, give up on it for a bit. But luckily, you know, in my county, there are two healthcare systems, two hospital systems, one of which set up for free telemedicine, and I was very much so looking forward to it. And apparently, it seems to be going decently. However, it's actually outsourced, so it's not really our healthcare system doing the telemedicine stuff. So I kind of wonder what that's doing with continuity. I actually have a follow-up appointment with my orthopedist via telemedicine, and I know that my physical therapist is doing some telemedicine for some people that can't make it in. So you got to wonder, are they really doing the assessment? Because have they really been trained on and given tips? Is there a tip sheet? I've never seen one for a tip sheet in terms of, hey, make sure you look for this kind of clue or that kind of clue. So it makes it a bit more different. And I worry that it might turn it a little bit more into whatever you want, you get. Oh, you have a cough, just in case, stay home. But here, let me write you all these antibiotics when you really don't even need it. And then you end up with all these other problems. Interestingly, we've had a very aggressive telemedicine from an EMS perspective. And the other physician and I that do the telemedicine for our county EMS, we're getting them outpatient testing as needed. But we also, neither of us really mind calling in certain scripts, like for an inhaler or something like that, which is going beyond what we're really initially sought out to do with the telemedicine. So it's a real interesting mix, but access to it and continuity, I really worry about.
Yeah, that could be a whole podcast right there. Jamie, we'll take you, and then David has a comment.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, I mean, it's interesting because my mother ended up having some cardiac workup right at the beginning of everything back in February, early March. And she had to wear a monitor for a week and go through the standard stuff. And everything worked out fine and everything's good with her, which is good to know. But all of her follow-up visits with the cardiologist and her primary care doctor, which turned into three different telemedicine visits, happened via that telemedicine resource. And thank goodness she lives with my sister, who was able to teach her how to FaceTime the first time. And then since then, she's been FaceTiming everybody. So once she learned to do it with their doctors three times, now she FaceTimes the whole family repeatedly. So it's not like it's not something that they can't learn. Just because somebody's older and hasn't used a technology before doesn't mean that they can't learn to use it proficiently. So I think there's hope there, at least in that respect.
Well, especially when it's the only link they have to their families, they're certainly willing to learn it. David, thoughts?
Well, I thought by telemedicine you meant pretending to be a doctor based on what you've seen on the television. And for me, that's going very well. I mean, all these emergency EMS regulations that have been implemented and the rules are being suspended and we can do whatever we want. And I've been doing a lot of prescription writing and some minor surgical procedures, and I'm not really comfortable saying anything more at this point.
Copy that. Sarah Francis, what are your thoughts so far on this?
Yeah, so, I mean, are we set up telemedicine pretty early on? The problem for our experience with telemedicine was that we had patients come to the emergency department. I didn't really want to keep them in the hospital and where they would be around COVID. They seemed like they could maybe go home and follow up, even with telemedicine. But we didn't know how to make the appointment. And we were kind of like, oh, well, someone will call you. Oh, I don't have a phone. Well, that's a problem. And then if they did have a phone, maybe they didn't have the charger to the phone. Or I didn't know my phone number, you know, to put into the appointment request. So those were some of our major problems with the telemedicine setup, was just trying to figure out how to do that in a population that may or may not have access to a phone.
Yeah, really good point. And I'm sure you have a lot of that in New York. Well, I got you. You made an interesting point in the sidebar earlier about austere medicine, but it seems like ERs now are dealing with austere medicine. Has that, you know, changed protocols? I know it's changed how you do business. What are your thoughts on that?
I can't really say that it's changed protocols. It's been more out of necessity. Our volume surpassed our resource limit really early into our surge. So we had to come up with ways to create PEEP for patients that we were bagging. Putting a glove over the PEEP valve port kind of created that until we could get them onto a vent. Running out of central lines and figuring out which other device would be best, whether it's like instead of a triple lumen, we put in a double lumen or some sort of cordless. And so basically it was a supply limitation. And then we had to create ICUs all over the hospital. So still some of the ICUs don't have telemonitors, so that creates a problem, but just they've all kind of drilled holes through the walls to pull the IV pumps outside into the hallway so the nurses can have limited exposure in the rooms. And so just kind of creating these resources out of pretty much nothing has been the biggest point in austere medicine within the hospital in New York City.
Well, it's interesting because you're learning some things, creating some things that, you know, might be beneficial later on should we ever face something like this. David, you had a thought on telemedicine, and then Seth.
Yeah, so, you know, Centers for Medicare Medicaid Services, CMS, issued an emergency, I guess not really an emergency, but they implemented a regulation, I guess about a month ago, that facilitated telemedicine in ways that weren't necessarily available before, by making it easier to bill for them and to address some cost sharing issues and so forth. And so when we got to talking about that, it was just a reminder to me about all over the landscape of medicine and EMS, we're doing things that everybody said were impossible just, you know, 2 or 3 months before. there are all these like super wicked problems and big policy fights. And would we ever see the day when paramedics could be telling patients, actually, you really probably don't need to go to the hospital for this, and that we're actually not going to transport you, and everything from that to the, you know, embracing telemedicine. We're doing all these things that everybody thought, you know, were never going to be done in any timely fashion. And I hope that we stick with some of those things. I mean, not all of them were probably good ideas once we start seeing how this all shakes out and probably seeing where we maybe pulled back regulations a little bit too quickly. Obviously, there's going to be some COVID lateral damage from some of those moves. But that was what I kept thinking about when we were talking about telemedicine, was that regulation being representative of things that we should hold on to. And I hope that, you know, we don't just go back to the ways that were inefficient and really bogging everybody down in just a ton of red tape.
Really? Well, maybe there'll be some COVID lateral good lessons to learn. Seth?
Yeah, we've been calling these COVID silver linings, and I think there are many of them. I think we know this from disasters in general, right? That oftentimes a disaster causes us to problem solve and to work around things that in the past seemed insurmountable. So just to jazz off what David is saying, I think EMS is seeing lots of sunshine on the idea that perhaps the only options for a transporting unit should not be patient refusal or take to the hospital. We know that that's not the case of what happens in the real world. Like, there's many more things that 911 gets called for that don't require emergency department care, but also aren't strictly refusals. And one of the major obstacles we've had over the years has been the inability for EMS agencies to bill for services that don't involve transport. So that's a good example of the sort of thing that during a disaster starts to become apparent that it's just not sustainable and solutions come around. So I think one silver lining is potentially reevaluating as a society the role that EMS plays in a disaster in terms of delivering services in and around homes and how critical that is, even if it doesn't involve patient transport. I think another element to this is medical oversight and telemedicine involving physicians, which is really exciting. So one of the things we've been exploring locally for me and across the country is the role that physicians can play in determining decisions like whether a patient needs to be transported or not, and coming up with telemetry solutions that can involve billing and can involve more involvement of the physician in the care. And that's a great thing. And then I think the third thing that really comes about from this is enabling or seeing the benefit to enabling paramedics to work at a scope where they can actually be autonomous caregivers in the field to the full extent of their capabilities, which I think, you know, involves thinking prospectively about training them to do medical decision making and actually be capable of doing more than just immediate stabilization and transport, which in a disaster setting could be huge and could be very critical. One of my colleagues, Justin Padgett at Landmark Learning, has done work for many years on this involving community resilience in disasters and recognizing that in a disaster where most of the infrastructure is impaired, which is not really the case in this one, it's going to be neighbors that are taking care of neighbors. So really expanding the ability of local EMS systems and local neighbors and caregivers to do the most that they can, I think, is important. And we're seeing here in this pandemic how important it is to get every care professional to be working to their full capability.
Amen on that. I want to go and see if Becky's got any thoughts since she's been in the background there. But Ben, one quick thing that you mentioned, doing some ultrasound telemedicine as a trial. How's that going?
Yeah, it's actually really interesting. And it talks about the power of Twitter, kind of companies that are trying to actually do things and go out. But we started trialing a new telemedicine feature with Butterfly that they have since, a couple weeks later, they went public about with the ability to do. But with our follow-up phone calls, because we have the telemedicine for the low risk, if they don't have to be transported, we're already calling the patients to follow up and say, hey, how are you still doing? Were you able to call your doctor? Do you need something else? Whatever. But we're actually also have been trialing and setting up the medics are able to go there and use the ultrasound, and I can do all the controlling and the knobology, so to speak, from my computer and follow up. And the sensitivity and specificity for pulmonary badness is better than an X-ray, and it's picking up on some things. And clinically, you know, these patients are definitely lower risk, but it's definitely also really making people feel a lot more comfortable. And has quite a potential there, because they're getting something more objective finding, and this really opens the door of things, just like what Pfeiffer was saying, really opening the doors to things that we would love to do, and we talk about the future and technology and use of this and that, but we were just called crazy 2 months ago, and now it's starting to get there. That this is the start of potential. Termination, resuscitation, or some advanced procedure abilities for my medics that are out in the wilderness or in a disaster situation that I can't be down there in there for, or something like that. So it's pretty interesting how it goes and pans out and playing with the technology. And I'll tell you too, the company has been extremely responsive with even tips and trying to make it even better. Ongoing. So that's been a pretty impressive thing with it. It's amazing where we're headed.
I see one of those COVID lateral silver linings there. And that should be your next article, Seth, is the silver linings that we're starting to see.
Yeah.
Becky, you've been in the background and we've been throwing a lot of information out. Any thoughts or questions for these guys so far?
I've mostly just been absorbing, but I do have one question. When it comes to kind of more rural communities, and I wouldn't even consider where I live to be rural, but we have volunteer ambulance corps, and I've been hearing a lot of concerns about struggling to raise funds because their means of doing that normally are not available. They've struggled to get PPE. I know somebody that had to write an emergency grant just to be able to fund it. Is there any concern for long-term implications of these ambulance services in rural communities that could have serious implications for a lot of these communities?
Seth, why don't you take that first? Because I know you have posted some stuff on just the general dilemma of volunteer responders as well, besides the financial aspect of, should I go or should I stay and stay safe? Why don't you run with that?
Yeah, I'd like to acknowledge it as an issue and then hand off to an actual academician in EMS, David Pfeiffer, who knows these topics far better than I do. But yeah, the New York Times ran a very good story, I think, on this issue. And I think just intuitively, we can all understand what's one of many things that's at stake. It's just the fact that these are volunteers who are leaving the houses that they're supposedly socially distancing in to go take care of other people. And I think one of my biggest concerns from my own experiences and then just what I understand nationally is that we are not yet at a point in our society where we really think of them as mainstream members of the healthcare system, and they don't necessarily have access to the same PPE and the same protections since they're seen as sort of citizen healthcare providers. And that gives me a great deal of concern, because certainly their risk and the interventions that they're providing are just as much healthcare as any other element of the chain of survival in the healthcare system. So I'd just like to acknowledge it. I give a huge tip of the hat during disasters and really during every day to volunteer EMS agents or EMS squads and fire departments and rescue squads, and hand it over to David to maybe hit a little deeper.
Well, I think numbers were helpful. So NAEMT and NREMT have taken a look at just how much volunteer EMS is out there. And they estimate that there's at least 13% of the nationwide EMS workforce is volunteer. I actually think that that number is probably low, because I think that they looked in that study that was a couple of years ago about people whose primary connection to EMS was volunteer. There's a lot of different kinds of volunteerism in EMS, and there are, you know, hybrid systems where they probably are listed primarily as being career departments, but rely very heavily on volunteers to complete their staffing models and so forth. I think those numbers are probably skewed a little bit low just based on the way that they asked that question. So there's a lot of volunteer EMS out there for sure. And, you know, funding models for volunteer EMS are a lot different as you go from state to state. So, you know, in places like New York and New Jersey, my impression is that they rely very heavily on direct fundraising. I think almost all squads probably do, but in states like Virginia, there are rescue squad is what the vernacular is there for volunteer EMS, rescue squad assistance funds administered by the state. And they're actually, they don't meet all the needs. And I think a lot of the volunteer squads in that state would say, you know, we need more money. But, you know, I happen to know that Virginia is, for example, is pretty generous, and they can actually provide a lot of the basic needs of the squads in terms of capital equipment, things like that. But they're driven by tax collections. So, and I see Jamie supplying some information to me here that Maryland has a very similar system, but they rely on tax collections. And so if people are losing their jobs and tax receipts on by the state are down, and in, you know, business taxes and income taxes and personal property taxes are all probably going to crater over the next fiscal year, even though squads that used to be pretty well supported by the taxpayers through systems like that, they're going to be in some big trouble. There's another side of this coin, though, which is that I actually think that we might be seeing a resurgence of volunteerism in EMS. There's, you know, a lot of people would argue that it has waned over the past few years, but there are some conversations I've been seeing play out about how volunteers can be used to supplement staffing when the primary career workforce needs to be quarantined after an exposure, or becomes ill, or something like that. And so agencies that don't have a pool of manpower to pull from like that are having a much harder time meeting their mission. So I think that volunteer EMS is going to have some rocky financial straits ahead, but if their value is being highlighted in a different way, we might actually see more donations and increased fundraising, at least in some areas.
Good point. Really good point. Jamie, this is a topic near and dear to your heart because you've been in the volunteer service for much of your life, eh?
Yeah, I mean, as far as my paramedic life, I was never paid. Just part of one of those rare birds of a paramedic volunteer. Most of the paramedics that volunteer in my local service are paid somewhere, whether it's Baltimore City or Baltimore County or up in Delaware. But I've seen, you know, most of the all the ambulance services around my area in Maryland and a lot of parts of Maryland are volunteer, and they're struggling. While they do get property tax assistance and they do medical billing as well, the problem that was mentioned earlier about we're not transporting, so we can't bill currently. And that may have changed. I'm not as tied into that as I used to be when I was chief, but I think that it's, you know, I think it's something that what David says is a good point, that we have an opportunity to bring volunteers back into helping the paid systems when needed, as an auxiliary force or something, much as the same way that police forces have auxiliary members. And it might be something worth exploring in the midst of this current crisis, because this crisis is here for a lot longer than a lot of people in the public, you know, understand. And I think there'll be opportunities to expand those types of services.
Well, that's another whole podcast we could do. We're going to switch gears here, but Seth, before I go on, you had a thought about something?
Well, it's a departure. Just came to mind as we were talking about rural areas and how healthcare gets delivered there. One thing that really interested me here in North Carolina was the closure of the bridge going across the Outer Banks to an island community because of COVID-19. And the closure actually included people who were landowners there who weren't full-time residents. And it just fascinated me as we think about rural versus urban environments. I think, you know, you've got people like me that are in a fairly rural kind of practice, and then people like Sarah Francis in New York City, and it's a real difference in that kind of operational environment. I think, you know, one of the factors as we talk about how people handle disasters is that there's been a supposition that you would retreat to a rural area if the bad thing happened. And like many people, I just watched Contagion recently, and not to give any, you know, spoilers, but in every kind of movie like that, there's a moment where the people in the know say, you know, pack up your bags and go to grandma's house in the Catskills, or like this, like, you know, trope of American disaster planning extends to things as sort of permanent and dire as climate change, to things as small as like a pandemic. So it's just interesting that we're now, among many other things, seeing theories tested. And one of them is that rural areas, A, could actually shut down, which is the whole idea of closures of state travel or travel within a state. It has been quite interesting. But then also the question has come up of how rural areas would be able to manage a surge of people from cities coming in who are trying to escape something like a pandemic. In this particular case in North Carolina, the hospital in question had like 20 beds, and they just said, we can't be the resource for people fleeing to their second home. The point, you know, has also been made that even the ability to flee is sort of a privileged situation. So it just interests me from a 10,000 foot view of American society dealing with disasters, that we're actually, for one of the first times, getting a real test of the idea that a certain privileged portion of the community has had, that they would retreat from their city environment to somewhere else, and that may or may not actually prove to be possible.
Yeah, the urban environments are really having issues, and again, that's a whole other podcast. But I want to switch gears a bit here and talk about providers. When you're talking about COVID lateral damage, you know, we know a lot of the general stuff going on in terms of worsening mental illness, domestic violence, child abuse, and all those kinds of things, which, of course, emergency providers have to be involved in if they end up coming into the ER, and certainly the people in the field. There's other things, too, like Seth, you referenced vents being given to a patient, telling a family the vent's going to be given to a patient with a better chance of survival, the fear of infection, the delay of care. So you guys are seeing much more serious issues like we mentioned earlier. Those kinds of things are really going to have an effect and have had an effect. We're seeing that already. And let's just focus on the ER for the moment. But how is this going to affect future responses to healthcare needs? The mental health of physicians, are people not going to trust the healthcare system? There's a million questions that can come up about that. And I want to kind of touch base with everybody on that. So David, you're up. So we'll start with you.
Well, I think the ways that this is going to affect EMS in particular, you know, that's my specialty, paramedic. I've worked in a hospital as an ER technician, but don't typically feel qualified to talk about that aspect of things, is I think we're going to finally start to see EMS take some things seriously that they just didn't before. And I think that we, as paramedics, we really just need to take some ownership over the fact that we weren't very good about infection prevention and infection control. We weren't great about, you know, sanitizing equipment and disinfecting between patients. A lot of agencies didn't take respiratory protection very seriously to begin with. You see a lot of paramedics, frankly, myself included, with beards, not really worrying about whether or not they'd really ever be able to get a good seal on their N95s. Because we were really just worried about, you know, like TB and things that didn't really seem like a really serious kind of transmission risk. And so I think for our piece, the thing that's really going to change is all that kind of stuff. I wouldn't be surprised if like half face elastomeric respirators become standard issue PPE, just like SCBA masks are for firefighters. I think you're going to start to see a lot of hospital kind of level disinfection with these different kinds of devices to spray down ambulances and UV light cleaning robots and things like that. It's going to become commonplace rather than sort of like novel. And I also think that some of what we're seeing with provider-initiated refusals and alternate destinations and some different kinds of approaches, sending what some agencies might call like a pilot car, not necessarily like a quick response vehicle, but somebody to kind of take a peek to see whether or not the patient really needs an ambulance or what they really need. Some of those things are going to catch on. It's going to reshape EMS. I also think that maybe there might be increased esteem for EMS. It seems like people might finally, the general public might kind of finally be starting to understand what we do, that it's more than just you call, we haul, and that there's actual healthcare being delivered in these ambulances by these personnel. And this might be maybe a sea change in public attitudes about EMS.
Wow, true. Amen to that, too. I'm saying that a lot tonight, but God knows I could use it. This reminds me a lot of ways of Ground Zero and how things kind of changed there as far as providers on the front line. So kudos to that. Sarah Francis, your thoughts on that? How are people doing in New York?
Yeah, I think it's going to take a lot of time to kind of sort out what the actual effects are, and how we manage those effects. I think talking kind of what David was talking about, what is going to be our standard PPE and how long is that going to last? And do we issue it like to our incoming interns? Right now, all of our, I would say a lot of our physicians have the half mask respirators. They're using those a lot, but they don't like the way that it hurts their nose. And so some find the N95 masks are a little bit more comfortable. So I guess it would, what's going to be issued for a prolonged period of time, I don't know. But I will say that you brought up the issue of trust and the trust in your team members and your trust in your administration to provide you what you need. That's going to be probably a really big issue. Especially within New York City. So the way that I'm seeing things happen right now is we have a lot of really great team members working together. I'm really proud of our immediate administration within our hospital providing us what we need and making sure that we feel safe where we are. But there's also this kind of underlying tone that I think is probably present everywhere, but it's like, stay away from me. Don't get near me. Where have your hands been? You know? And I think that that's a little bit detrimental to the health of the team in general. And I don't know how long that's going to last or if there's any way to make it a little bit better. And then just the mental health of each provider. The questions that everybody has is how long are you contagious? And every day you go home, you take your mask off, and you just think, like, this could be the day that I contracted this virus. And what is that going to mean for me? Am I going to be the one with mild symptoms or with no symptoms? Or am I going to pass it on to somebody? And so I think that that's a acute but prolonged stressor. And I'm not really sure what the answers are. We have mental health providers that are available to talk, but I think that they don't really know the answers to that either. So talk therapy only does so much, but we have to implement some sort of process that's going to make everybody feel more standard and safe, and it's going to be issued and be there when we need it most. So
yeah, it's going to be a long road. Seth, you know, you in one of your articles, you talked a lot about the fear response now and in the future, which kind of segues into this. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, this is a fascinating national experiment in enrolling the public into healthcare. So the typical pattern is you go into a doctor's office or a PA or nurse practitioner's office, you get seen, and that's your interface with the healthcare system. And in sort of the outward bound crew, not passengers model, every American is now asked to be crew and not a passenger in the healthcare endeavor to reduce death from this virus. And that's super challenging. It enrolls the public into many things that we do and are used to that's fearful. We as healthcare providers and we as citizens are afraid of dying from an invisible virus that we can't predict and that we don't totally understand. So there's fear of the unknown and there's fear of death. I think there's lots of silver linings about this. And I think, as we've said, there's many things that are great that are going to come out of it. One of the, just to be transparent and open, one of my fears coming out of all this is sort of the what I think is kind of the 800-pound gorilla in the room that's not being referenced, which is tackling a pandemic in the post-truth era. So I had been hopeful that as time went by, we would start to come together as a country and recognize a unified threat, and that historical markers had always told us that we would be very we'd have a lot of fisticuffs until we met a common enemy, and then we'd all align together and work to fight that. And that's been the experience of multiple world wars as well as multiple public health threats. So I think a real interesting factor of this is that that isn't quite as much happening. In fact, the very nature of the threat is now contested, and we're not sure what the data says. We're not sure if this is a political situation. We're not sure what testing means or if our data is correct. We don't trust as much our mainstream media, perhaps, and we don't trust traditional healthcare authorities like the World Health Organization, which we're now unfunding, or the CDC, which is sort of our the body of scientists that we task with public health preparation and mitigation in a pandemic. So to me, that's interesting. There's a little bit of fear for me around that in just the fact that it's something that exists. But I think also we should have real concerns about a country in disaster management in an era where there's not even necessarily agreement on the nature of the disaster. I think for a flood or a hurricane, it can be called into question until that incident hits your city. And in this case, frankly, I think probably Sarah Francis's and David Pfeiffer's experience have been very different with this, and yet it's still considered to be a national threat. So I think in summation, there's lots of things to be that are important to think about as far as managing fear. And I think learning how to package fear and use it in helpful ways is something that disaster professionals and healthcare professionals get used to, and that's something that hopefully we can share with the general public right now as everybody is kind of sharing this experience of trying to manage a medical condition. Underlying that, I think, it are real questions about our handle on sort of science and reality as we face this situation.
Wow, we have a lot of work to do on that, clearly, and a lot of lessons learned. And Ben found his mute button, so we'll get comments from him. And the last thought I want to throw out here, because we're winding down, and Ben, I'll let you start with this, but you guys talked about safety third some time ago, and I don't think it's more appropriate than now in this COVID environment. So, Ben?
Yeah, so the right now of all times, it really is an important aspect and thing to think about. I'm really proud that we kind of even re-brought it up, because, and specific to the COVID-19, because you hear a lot of things and it's scary in terms of it's an invisible enemy, right? So there are still people that think that it doesn't exist, that it's not an issue, yet we're seeing people dying. We're seeing people permanently injured from it. And you have stressors coming from different directions. We'll go and do something, do your job. It's your job to go in without PPE. It's your job to go in and do this and that, some people would argue. But you can't take care of everybody if you don't also take care of yourself. And, you know, still walking around the hospital and you'll see the safety first kind of things. And there are people that are, I'm lucky, you know, I don't have my bosses saying, you know, your safety is our first priority. Oh, by the way, you don't get a mask. We're being well protected. And we're not being expected to go in if we don't have the appropriate personal protective equipment. So right now, of all times, it's really important to realize the risk mitigation in terms of what you want to do and how you want to do things. And we have to do things a lot differently just out of necessity, and have to stop, take a breath. And it sometimes it really does turn into a don't just do something, stand there moment, so you can make sure before you're even going to a cardiac arrest, just like we go into hazmat situations where you're making sure that your partner is fully donned the correct personal gear, not, oh, I'm just going to go in and get CPR started while the others put the PPE in. It really changes things up.
Really, and the premise of safety third is, especially in EMS, you're never safe on a scene. I mean, you could be taking care of a broken toe and there's a guy in the next room with a knife. So, you know, to say that we're completely safe is just not feasible. Sarah Francis, final thoughts?
Yeah, definitely. safety third rings within our department for sure, and throughout the U.S., just looking at kind of everywhere, our homes, our grocery stores, our parks, they're just not completely safe right now. Were they ever is a question. But we have to look at our mission, and I think everybody's really focused on this mission, which has been uplifting. And our hearts are in it, and we're there because we want to be there. But we do have to recognize that there's a real threat to our own health. And like Ben was saying, we go in as a buddy system, we put our PPE on, and we do what we need to do, and then we take our PPE off together so that we can recognize if there was a breach in that PPE doffing. So I think that safety third is really important to remember and kind of plant in our brains for the future as well.
Well, and a point you made is safety third is expanded out to kind of the whole world right now. David, your thoughts?
Well, like you said, EMS has always been pretty inherently dangerous, but I don't actually think that we have acknowledged that it is in all cases. And it seems like there was a lot of emphasis over the past few years on roadway safety. We recognize that that was actually the leading cause of line of duty deaths was transportation related incidents. And then more recently, maybe some of the mental health ramifications. But I think now we're really seeing that. Now there's a new recognition, or maybe a renewed recognition, that infection is a big risk. And, you know, something like COVID-19, where we don't even fully understand how it's transmitted and in what circumstances and that kind of stuff, and if we have immunity to it and other things like that, you know, safety third becomes the order of the day. I mean, we have to keep treating patients. We have to keep responding to calls. We're changing the way that we do that. But you can't just shut the doors to the bay and lock them because there's this new scary disease out there.
Amen to that, too. And finally, Dr. Seth.
Yeah, I think the important thing for listeners to hear who are new to this concept is that safety third in no way minimizes the importance of safety. What it does try to acknowledge is that what we're all really interested in is completing a mission. And if safety was the most important consideration, healthcare providers would stay at home just like everyone else is being encouraged to do so. And part of the essential nature of what we think healthcare providers are doing in this environment is going into places like emergency departments and hospitals and areas that their services are needed because a mission has to be completed. So I think it just is a more accurate acknowledgement of what the risk management profile is. But as Sarah Francis was saying, the ability to complete a mission depends on things like PPE and other safety features that are intrinsic to mission completion. So it's not in any way to try to suggest that safety is an important element for everyone during this time, but that it's probably not fair to say that it's the first priority. We think that having passion in what you do and alignment with your mission and working to complete the mission is the first priority. And then safety forms an element of both of those. So just want to reiterate that for folks who may be tapping into this dialogue for the first time. This is not to be cavalier in any way. It's just to recognize a bit of what Ben was getting at, that if you ever look to somebody else to look out for your safety because, hey, you work in a hospital where safety is first, so you don't need to worry about it, you are doomed. Safety needs to be the first consideration for all of us as we complete our own individual missions at this time.
Well said, Dr. Seth, as usual. And Jamie, I don't think we've ever packed as much good information in one podcast as we did tonight, because I love these guys. Their heart is totally in what they do, and I'm sure you can put up some links to the many articles that we talked about, and we'll have them back, certainly.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I've been, I put a little teaser post up on the Disaster Podcast group, letting them know a few of the topics they'd be hearing in tomorrow's episode, because this has been very informative, very thought-provoking, and I think that's one of the things we strive to do here on the show. So I want to thank everybody that was on the show tonight for that. The other thing is that, the paradigm shift that is happening in disaster planning, what it means to be prepared, all those things are shifting right now, and certainly in the training realm as well. And I always have to take it back to our very generous supporters for the show that help us bring an episode out every week, Dr. Joe Holly and the folks over at Paragon Medical Education Group. So thank them very wholeheartedly for their continued support. Definitely check in with them, get familiar with their site, so when training resources start opening up again, you have an opportunity to try to get them in to work with you. You can find them over at paragonmedicalgroup.com. There are also links to them on our website at disasterpodcast.com, and over at the Disaster Podcast Facebook group as well. You can catch up with them as well. But wanted to thank them for that. Real quick, I'm going to just go do a quick roundtable for everybody that's here to shoot out your how to get in hold of you information. So, Becky, we'll start with you. Where can folks find you on the web?
Most common place to find me is on Twitter at WX_Becks, BECKS, and always the Disaster Podcast Facebook group.
Awesome. Thank you. Dr. Seth.
Yeah, I've got a unified at HawkVokes, V-O-X, handle on Instagram and Twitter, also on Facebook under my name. David Pfeiffer and I both have a podcast as well, the Raw Medicine Podcast,
which is a great podcast resource, and I urge people to check it out for sure. Definitely. David, while we have you while we're talking about you, how about you?
Well, I am pretty active on social media, to say the least, and you can find me just under my name. My Twitter and Instagram handles are down to Pfeiffer, but they're all, you know, under David Pfeiffer, and I am the one with the beard in Richmond, Kentucky.
Sounds good. Well, so you're the only one in Richmond, Kentucky that has a beard, or
100% certain.
Okay, great. Easy to find you then. Awesome. Sarah Frances, how about you?
Hey, yeah, you can find me on Twitter at SassafrasMC and Instagram at AnnieMeetsNYC.
Awesome. Wonderful.
And Sarah does not have a beard, just saying.
Just to clarify.
Yes, just to clarify. But we are getting back to the beard because we're going to go back to Ben. And Ben, how can folks find you, your banana phone, and all your other antics?
So definitely anytime, anywhere on banana phone. I find that very appealing. But most of my handles, of course, are my name, Ben Abo. So that's Instagram, that's Twitter. And on Facebook, it comes up as Ben Abo or Ben Without Borders.
Thanks, Ben. And
yes, you are.
People would enjoy following you on social media, I think. It's always fun and informative, which is great to be available and find out there. Sam, I think I got everybody, did I?
Well, you and me, but they've heard enough of us.
They have indeed. Why don't you just go ahead and take us out, and folks can just find us over at disasterpodcast.com or on the Disaster Podcast Facebook group. And Sam, you got it.
Yes, the Facebook group is growing rapidly, which shows that we must be putting out some good information. And I hope everybody listens to this one, because this is a huge brain trust we've taken advantage of here. And I think, rather than the tagline, my final thought is, let's keep looking for those COVID silver linings, because they're out there. And the things we'll learn from this are going to be helpful in the future. So let's look for those COVID silver linings.